This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, you are listening to Earth Matters. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Earlier this month, a whale was rescued by a group of people in Pantai Rambah, Pontian, but sadly the beautiful cetacean was found beached again in shallow waters along Sungai Sarang Buaya a few days later and subsequently died. Dr. Louisa Panampalam and Fairuz Ismail, the co-founders of the Maraset Research Organization, joins me now to give some factual afterthoughts about the stranding and death of the whale from Johor and to clear up some misleading facts that were put out in the news about the incident. Welcome to the show. How are things going at Maraset before we get to this particular whale? How have things been since the last time that we had you on the show?
It's been good. It's been really, really good. We're keeping busy. We're approaching 5 years of our establishment. So we've been doing a lot of research still in Langkawi and Kuala Sepetang, and I've started a project on dugongs in Johor as well. So it's been a really good 4 years since.
I think I'm speaking for a lot of people who don't naturally associate whales with Malaysian waters. You know, a lot of people are surprised that whales are found in our waters at all. Are there a lot of whales aside from, you know, different cetaceans found around Malaysia?
In Malaysia, we have a total of 27 species of marine mammals, ranging from whales, dolphins, porpoises and dugongs. There are tropical species of whales, as there are tropical species of dolphins and porpoises, as well as cold water species of these animals. So we do have species of whales that have been found in Malaysian waters. One of the more commonly cited species of whale in this region, which is a tropical region, is the Brutus whale. So it is not unsurprising that we should have whales in our waters, but there are many people whom we have spoken to that are surprised when we say, oh, we saw a whale in Langkawi on our survey last month, that sort of thing. And a lot of the reaction is, but, you know, I thought they're just in cold water and, you know, aren't they just migrating through or are they lost? And the answer is no, they're not lost. They're not migrating through. They do live around here. In fact, up in the Gulf of Thailand, in the upper Gulf of Thailand, there is a population of Brutus whales that are there almost year-round in shallow water, and they breed there, they feed there, and that's where they live. So, and it's definitely tropical water.
Is there a reason that tropical whales and dolphins don't get as much exposure as cold water whales and dolphins? I think when we think of this image of, you know, a whale or a dolphin, we tend to have a very specific image of the kinds of things we see in encyclopedias, I guess, you know, your blue whales, your sperm whales and so on. And they're not tropical whales. Why is that?
I think it's because of the level of research that has been done over the, you know, last few years, decades. The research on marine mammals is a lot more advanced in Western countries and places like Australia and New Zealand, whereas in Asia, and especially Southeast Asia, a lot of the work is only been in the last 10 years or so, maybe. So, and then, of course, that's the research level is in its infancy, but also getting the information out there. I mean, in the last few years with social media, things have really boomed. But also, this knowledge about or this perception that these animals are from cold water or colder water is also due to popular media, so such as movies, documentaries that, you know, are produced in the West and made available for us to watch. So naturally, people don't associate these animals with tropical regions.
When it comes to tropical whales, then, are they mostly resident populations, transients or vagrants?
I would say we don't know much about their movement patterns. We do know that they live around here. We don't know if it's seasonal. We don't know if they come and go. But based on general information of these species that we know, these tropical whales, they do not undertake those long-distance migration routes like certain species do, such as grey whales and humpback whales. So we think that they are locally available, meaning that they may move up and down along a coast. They may move inshore, offshore, according to a certain season, perhaps. But how resident they are, we don't have data. I don't think they're vagrants. And I don't really think that they're transient either. Transient would just mean that you're just passing through. So they're around, but not long-ranging like other species.
I read in a local newspaper that there have been 11 cases of beached whales and dolphins in Malaysia's coastal areas in the last 3 months. Is this accurate to your knowledge?
To our knowledge, yes. We have been getting reports in the last few months. of these stranding cases. Some of them were reported in newspapers, in the media. Some of them we just got the reports from third parties, you know, through SMS, WhatsApp, those type of social media networks. From what we know, yeah, about 11 that's been reported so far.
And is that considered a rise in numbers?
We don't know, to be honest, because previously, when we first started doing our research here, there's not been a lot of reports of stranding cases. We've been seeing a lot more, and that's probably because people are more aware of who to call or who to inform when they see a stranding. Whether it is a rise in the cases or it's just a rise in the number of reports that we've been receiving, we're not too sure.
Having said that, Marisat has come out to say that some of the facts presented in the media about the whale that died in Johor was inaccurate. Could you elaborate on that?
One of the first things that we did, and we always do when we first come upon a stranding incident, is to determine what species it is. And in the case of that whale in Johor that just died last week, we consulted some whale experts from overseas who have, you know, years and years of experience working on whale taxonomy and ecology. So based on the photographs that we could find online, we sent it to them to ask for their opinion. Of course, we also had an opinion of what it was, and we thought it, based on the presence of the three parallel ridges that was on the head of the whale, we thought, I think it looks like a Brutus whale, not a Sei whale, as has been reported in the media. So we double-checked with these experts, and after scrutinizing the videos and the photographs that were available, they too were of the opinion that it was a Brutus whale. However, the taxonomy of Brutus whale all over the world is currently still complicated and in question, and there are 2 to 3 species of Brutus whales that exist. So they were not able to tell us exactly which species of Brutus whale it was, but just based on the fact that the whale had the three parallel ridges on its head, which is a distinctive identifying feature of Brutus whales, we are sure that it was a Brutus whale. Yeah,
I understand that there were also some reports about the mud that was found in the whale's respiratory tract and lungs. Did that lead to the stranding? I mean, was it a cause of it or was it a result of it?
It's hard to say. I mean, we were not there. We didn't see the whale for ourselves. But based on what we know, and again, in consulting with experts, the mud was probably a consequence of why it had died, not a direct result of its death. So if we look at photos, the whale was already very emaciated, meaning very skinny, and you could see its ribs protruding out of its, from the outside, you could see the ribs protruding. So this whale was already unwell at the time that it first stranded in Pontian, and then I think within 48 hours, it died. So it was actually a whale that was unwell, and therefore that's why it came ashore and stranded. And of course, the natural thing to do would be to put it back out into the sea, because we're not just going to leave an animal to die there, right? So, but because it was already unwell, it died, and then it stranded again, this time in Batu Pahat. So we don't know what really happened. We don't know where exactly it died, at what point it died. But what we know based on its appearance is that there was something wrong with it. So the mud in the lungs could have been a result of whatever was wrong with it before that caused it perhaps to get mud into its respiratory tract and its lungs.
I understand that a post-mortem also found pieces of plastic rubbish in the whale's stomach, badly damaged internal organs, and a parasite in the carcass. As you said just then, it sounds like this was, to begin with, a whale that had existing health issues, you know, beyond just kind of being out of the water. But could you elaborate on what all these different things might have meant?
From the news reports, it didn't sound like the stomach of the whale was full of plastics. So I think it's unlikely that plastic rubbish caused it to die because of, indigestion. It sounds like it was like pieces of shredded plastic. But again, we weren't there, so we're just basing this on what we read in the news. Badly damaged internal organs. Again, it was a whale that was already unwell, but nobody had examined, of course, the whale at the first time that it stranded in Pontian. So we don't know exactly what its organs were looking like when it died, when it was first found in Pontian. And of course, when it died, it was taken out of the water quite quickly and it was still quite fresh. So I can't say why it had damaged internal organs, except perhaps just a combination of decomposition and problems, pre-existing problems with the whale. As for the parasite, we have to remember that these animals are wild animals and they live in a wild environment in the ocean. And in the ocean, there are a lot of parasites and, you know, marine lice and things like that. So in our experience of having attended post-mortems of cetaceans and even dugongs, parasites are a common thing in these animals, and they don't necessarily cause the animal to die. They're just part of the biome of this whale's biology. They may be parasitic, they may just sit in there and do their own thing without causing much harm to the animal, but it's not unusual to find parasites. And I wouldn't say immediately that it's because of the parasites that the whale was unwell.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Louisa Panampalam, as well as Fairuz Ismail, both of the Maraset Research Organization. We're talking about marine mammal strandings. We've been talking about, of course, the whale that was found washed up in Johor. Next, we find out the causes for whales to beach themselves and whether this is something that we should be concerned about. You're listening today to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Earth Matters. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me, Dr. Louisa Panampalam and Fairuz Ismail, both part of the Maraset Research Organization, and we're talking about marine mammal strandings, specifically, of course, the whale that was found dead in Johor. I think for a lot of people, it's so strange. I mean, the idea that whales would beach themselves is something that, you know, it's you're flinging yourself out of your environment. What are some of the reasons for whales to behave like that, to do that?
There are a variety of reasons why a whale or a dolphin or a dugong, for that matter, would strand itself. One is that because it was ill, as I've mentioned earlier. So animals do get ill. They are living things. So just like us, they can get ill. But they are wild animals, so, you know, there isn't really always that opportunity to send them to the vet or to the doctor. So sometimes they're ill because of old age, because, again, they do get old. They are living organisms. Or because of disease. They are susceptible to various diseases. And or also because of plastic ingestion. So that causes them to be ill, disoriented. You know, you can't feed for days because your stomach is just stuffed with plastics and you can't digest it, you can't eat, and you get ill and you strand. The other reason is because it could be that the animal was injured by some sort of human activity, either a boat strike, a ship strike, or entanglement in fishing gear. Sometimes these animals are, I wouldn't say lucky, but I guess they do get away from these incidents. They are not killed on impact, or they're not killed right away from the entanglement. They do get away, but they are weakened because they are injured. In the case of an entanglement in fishing gear, sometimes they do break free, but then part of that fishing gear remains wrapped around their tail or their body or whatnot. And, you know, for the next few weeks or few months, if depending on how strong the animal is, they may survive, but then that gear starts cutting into their skin, causing wounds and damage that can become infected. And sometimes these infections do become worse and it can cause eventual death. And then again, they do strand. And sometimes it's because of changes in the marine environment that they are disorientated and lose their way. And, you know, maybe it's a change in currents, there's been a theory about magnetic fields that they're following to navigate, and they lose their way, and again, then they come ashore. Or in certain species, such as pilot whales, where the social bonds within a pod is very, very strong, sometimes if one member of the pod strands, there is that need or that feeling for the rest of the pod members to offer care and assistance to this whale that has stranded. So they all follow suit, and then they all do, you know, they all strand together in what we call as mass strandings, which we've seen in other parts of the world. That said, the issue of mass strandings is still quite poorly understood. I mean, there are few theories about why, but nobody really knows exactly why. And of course, an animal strands because sometimes they die at sea for all of the reasons that I've just mentioned. They do die at sea, and, you know, the tide and the currents bring them into shore, and that's when they land on our beach and that's when we find them. But there are a lot of cases of animals dying out there as well that, you know, we never know about.
Because we don't see.
We don't see. You know, they're washed out, they sink, they're eaten by sharks. So a stranding is, an animal comes ashore because of all those reasons, but also because the tide and the currents wash them in.
So with that said, I think it can be quite an upsetting thing to see a stranding. But is it something that we should be worried about overall from an ecological standpoint?
Well, it depends. It depends on the cause of death. I think that's why it's important for us to really try to determine what is causing the strandings. So it can be worrying when there are cases where stranding come one after another in a very short period of time, and that might be an alarm bell should start ringing because they don't usually strand, and it's highly unlikely for a number of animals to die in large masses in a very short period of time. But if it's just the cause of the death is due to natural causes, then it's a circle of life. It's a natural cause. The animal strand, so it's not really that worrying. So it depends on what caused the death in the first place.
Which is why it's important to find out, right?
To find out.
Okay. Yeah. Are there incidents of beachings and strandings that are precipitated by an activity that we're doing, you know, like when we release pollutants or shipping noise or sonar? Does that cause beachings and strandings?
There have been instances. There have been cases that has been reported in many parts of the world where they discovered that the animal had strand due to exposure to noise. And usually this is really sudden noise, things like seismic noise or sonar, for example. Sometimes it's because of injuries. Use of dynamite underwater can cause concussion, can cause the animal to be disoriented and get damaged organs, and that caused them to strand as well. So there have been instances and things like entanglement, like Louisa mentioned earlier, that also can cause stranding.
However, strandings, from what I understand, have been recorded since Aristotle's time, you know, and that is pre-sonar, pre-dynamite, pre-fishing nets. So are they just a natural phenomenon? Could it be, you know, just one of those things about nature, like lemmings, you know, where it just happens and that is just what it is?
Yeah, no, definitely. There have been natural causes of strandings. And yeah, it's been recorded since things have been recorded. And basically, it can be a natural phenomenon. It can be, like Louisa said, there are theories about magnetic fields, about changes in the environment that cause them to strand. The thing is, we don't have a definitive answer when it comes to causes of stranding. A lot of this, we're still going with theories. And we're trying to figure it out with colleagues around the world through understanding the cause of death whenever a stranding occurs.
Louisa, earlier you talked about how, you know, when you have a stranded whale, even if they're sick, you know, if you're not sure yet, you can't just leave them there. You know, the impulse is always to try and return them to the water. But if they are sick or if they are diseased, you know, are we doing more harm than good? Are we, especially by reintroducing, you know, a possibly infected or diseased animal into the pod?
Well, there is always that risk of that. But the thing is, with an animal that's already sick and come ashore, is that that animal is lost to its population. It's a lost individual. We can consider that animal as dead. And a lot of times, even if it comes ashore and we put it back into the water, it doesn't get back to its original pod where it came from, either because it's just too weak to swim all the way out to where it, you know, came from, or it, in the process of doing so, it might die, and it may wash back ashore in the same place or along the same coast, or the currents may take it completely somewhere different, but it will eventually end up dead somewhere else. So there is that risk. However, I think that an animal is already lost to a population. Also, having said that, sometimes when you do get to rescue an alive animal and it is given excellent tip-top veterinary care around the clock, depending on what the problem is with the animal, it can be rehabilitated to a certain health again. But then vets may decide that this animal is non-releasable. So they're not going to euthanize it, but they it's non-releasable. So if there's a facility that can care for it for the rest of its life, then they would keep it in this facility, perhaps as an educational organism for kids that come to the rehab center or whatnot. But certainly whether it goes back out and it dies or it gets rehabbed and unreleasable, that animal is already lost to its population.
When a whale is stranded alive, what happens to it? I mean, it's a mammal, but it's a marine mammal. So when it's lying there exposed to the sun, what's happening as, you know, to its body?
So these animals are made for an entire life living in the water. They're not like seals, where they come out for part of the time to rest or bask in the sun or socialize. They spend all their lives in the water from birth to death. So in the case of a whale, these are huge, I mean, very big animals, you know, made up of blubber and muscle mass and heavy bones, of course, that when it gets stranded alive, even though they are air-breathing animals, just like us, they have lungs, so they're not fish, so they don't breathe with gills like fish. Even though they can breathe out of water, what happens to the organs is the weight out of the water, because in the water, these heavy organs are supported by
the buoyancy
in the water. So out of water, it's very heavy. That a lot of times they die from the lungs just collapsing from the sheer weight. And of course, then everything else goes haywire and doesn't work anymore.
So should a whale be found dead or die, you know, after it's beached, how do you go about assessing the cause of death, since that's such an important thing in terms of understanding what's really going on out there in the water?
Some deaths are obvious. Like, for example, if the whale was struck by a big ship's propeller and there's a huge gash that you cannot miss that it's from a ship strike. Or there are very clear signs of entanglement, either because there is gear still around it or deep cuts and scars from fishing gear. Those things are quite obvious that you can tell off the bat, okay, it is almost likely that this animal died because it got hit or because it got entangled. But often we cannot tell because either the animal already comes in quite decomposed or there are no telltale signs externally. So the best way to go about assessing the cause of death of a whale would be to do a detailed post-mortem in what we call necropsy. Necropsy are animal autopsies, basically. And we would need to look at every aspect of this whale's carcass, the condition of its body, the tissues, was there hemorrhaging, are there lesions and growths, internal growths and tumors growing inside. And we take samples, of course, to help us determine why this animal died. So even if you do a necropsy, you may find, okay, there's a lot of plastic in its stomach, so most likely that's why. But if there's nothing, then you know, you need to take samples to the lab to do histopathological work or blood work to find out, okay, was it some sort of disease? Was it some sort of poisoning that caused it to die? So I think looking at every angle, internal and external examination and then histopathological examination is important.
And just to add to that, I think it's also important as you're going through that process is to also knowing as best as you can how the animal lived its life, like the life history. So, you know, you will not go into a necropsy across the board and in the same way. So you might treat, let's say, a baleen whale, knowing full well that it's a filter feeder and it usually just feed on the surface. Then you would have that kind of idea what to look out for. And if it's a toothed whale or a dolphin that hunts fish or squid or whatever, you will know that kind of diet that they go for, and that would actually help guide in that necropsy. So understanding the species that you're dealing with would actually help.
So that's from a scientific point of view. For somebody who lives by the beach or just happens to be at the coastline when a beaching or stranding occurs, you know, so we come across this mammal, dead or alive, what should we be doing? Who should we be contacting? What do we do? I mean, it's just something that I think a lot of people want to know.
Yeah, and I think our first advice, to be honest, whether it's dead or alive, don't touch the animal. It's a wild animal. There might be parasites, there might be virus, there might be bacteria on the animal that can be transmitted to you. So it is a health concern. And we are very concerned whenever we see strandings and you see the crowd, you know, all over the animal.
There's no crowd control.
There's no crowd control. And we have to realize that this is an animal that's been living in the wild for quite some time. If it's a live animal, once you've informed authorities, whether it's the Department of Fisheries, the fire department, the police, they will know then who to contact. And we, of course, would like to be informed as well so that we can also help wherever we can. But yes, definitely don't touch the animal. Don't go anywhere near the animal because it's a big animal and one swipe from its tail can actually cause you massive injuries. You don't want to be to be near an animal that's distressed. It can cause you bruises and quite a bad injury, to be honest.
So as a child, I read a story, you know, with a beached whale in which, you know, a whole village kind of went out there with buckets and sort of helped to, you know, try and keep the animal hydrated, pour water on it, make sure that its skin doesn't dry out. Is that something we shouldn't be doing then? I mean, so once we have called the authorities, is there nothing else that we should do except kind of wait?
You can assist. It's just that if you're not sure, the best way is as in any first aid situation, if you're not sure, then don't. You might cause more harm than good, to be honest. But if you can, just probably keep it damp, keep it wet. Use some damp towels, just kind of put it on the body, cover it from the sun, and wait for the authorities to arrive.
And it's always important to assess the situation. So is it dead? Is it alive? And if it's alive, how agitated is the animal? So as Farrell said, if it's agitated and it's flicking its tail back and forth, you could get injured. So it's about assessing the situation, and someone needs to take a lead in exercising crowd control. And people can come with their buckets of water to gently pour over the animal every so often till help arrives. But certainly, you know, it just depends on the scenario.
And the animal in question.
And the animal in question, yes.
Do you think that training on issues pertaining to marine mammal strandings is vital for the local and fishing communities around our coastal areas? I mean, here in KL, I guess it really would be a freak incident for us to kind of be in contact with a marine mammal that's been stranded. But for people living in Terengganu, you know, for people living along those areas who live off the sea, you know, do they need to understand these issues a little better, perhaps?
Most definitely. And from our set's experience, we have done some workshops with local communities in the places that we worked previously. And that is where we've seen a lot more participation and a lot more reports coming out of those areas whenever there's a stranding. Like I mentioned previously, I don't think there was that bit of an awareness where whenever there's a stranding that they should contact anybody. And now we've been getting those reports and we provide advice over the phone on what they can, what they should do until the responders arrive.
We also have it in a pipeline for this year that if we are able to secure some funding, we intend to run some of these community workshops nationwide with some of our colleagues from Sabah and Sarawak side in certain places where, particularly where we know strandings are taking place more than others. And we plan to run these workshops to tell people or teach people how to identify an animal and then what to do when you first arrive on site and you're still waiting for help from the authorities.
In the work that you've done, are most members of the community, particularly fishermen, aware that dolphins, whales and dugongs are protected under the Fisheries Act 1985 and the International Trade in Endangered Species of 2008?
They know that the species is protected, not the law specifically.
Right, they don't cite it every time.
Yeah, but they don't know which act, but they know that it's a protected species. And a lot of them, to be honest, know that the species of like whales or dolphins is important ecologically as well. And Malaysia has been quite lucky in the sense that we don't really have any of these fishermen or the community, coastal community, going out to actually hunt these animals because of their perception on these animals as being a key part in the ecosystem.
I suppose it's also an advantage of the fact that we don't have the same image of our whales as we do of, you know, the classic sort of free willy image. And so there's not that kind of trade happening here. What are some of your recommendations or hopes to the stakeholders involved when it comes to, you know, the stranding and death of the whale in Johor?
At Marisat, we believe very much in the concept of collaboration. We believe that one person or one organization can't do everything. Even certainly us as a young NGO, we can't do everything. And we always would like to collaborate with the various stakeholders on the ground, you know, the government agencies, the local communities, in handling a whale or dolphin or dugong stranding, because everybody brings different skills and different knowledge to the table. So why not work together? So it is our hope that for future stranding events, we will be able to work well and work together and have the opportunity to work together with the authorities and other stakeholders that are involved.
This is an aside, and it didn't happen in our country, but it's been hitting the news anyway. Just last week, a rare baby dolphin died on the beach in Buenos Aires in Argentina after tourists pulled it out from the ocean so they could take selfies with it. I mean, there were some really terrifying images, actually, of people kind of crowded around this very tiny dolphin. What are your thoughts on this, and a message to anyone who might think this is an acceptable practice and, you know, this is something they can do when they're in the sea?
For us, dealing with the conservation of these animals, it's sad. It's a sad event, and it's a disappointing event to know that people still think it is acceptable to use animals or trees or other living beings as toys, basically. We have to understand that these animals, you know, they are living beings. They have their own lives, and we believe that that old saying that says, do unto others, right? Yeah, so don't think this is acceptable in any instance involving any species. They are there to live, and we should just live the same way and help them out and achieve the balance in the ecosystem.
I guess the equivalent would be a dolphin drowning a human trying to take a selfie.
Probably,
kind of dragging you out of your environment and, you know, just for the sake of doing something silly.
I think that people get excited because it's such a novel thing. You don't see a dolphin every day, you don't get access to it every day. So people get overexcited and then they forget that it's also a living thing. It's not a squidgy soft toy. But so we have to just remind ourselves that it is a living thing and we need to respect its life.
I understand that Marisat is working together with local personality Davina Goh on a fundraiser campaign. Could you tell me more about that?
Yes, we're very excited that Davina has decided to support ocean conservation by supporting Marisat and another NGO, Reef Check Malaysia, in a swimathon this year. I think she said it would be her sort of biggest challenge yet that she's taken on. She will be participating this April in the Kapas Marang International Swimathon, where she will be swimming 6.5 kilometers across the South China Sea from Pulau Kapas to Marang. And that's, you know, open ocean, open water. She's training very hard every day for it. And it is an attempt to raise money for both our organizations to do our conservation work. So we are promoting this and we hope people can support her very good cause and intention. And they can do so online at the website. Yeah, so we're very excited. And I think Davina's campaign, you know, is not just about, you know, raising funds, but also raising awareness about why it's important to conserve the ocean. And I think of it as her swim carrying the message of, you know, there'll be a lot of challenges swimming 6.5 kilometers. That's how many times, how many laps nonstop of an Olympic-sized pool. And her swim really carries the message that of the challenges that we face in the marine environment, because, you know, it's not going to be an easy feat. She might have currents to deal with. She might have stingy little things in the water, you know, nibbling at her as she swims. And those things are challenging. And so in a way, it's raising awareness about all these challenges in the marine environment. But if we worked hard, we can do something good and make a difference.
For those of us who, you know, don't have that capacity yet to swim the 6.5 kilometers in support, how else can we support the work that you do?
You can run. the thing is with Marisat, we always want to get to know people and to work with others. We work with many other people who are not in this field, not scientists, not researchers. So we do get help from businesses, those involved in marketing, public relations, communications, and so
on. Designers.
So, yeah, your skill can definitely bring something to the table. Of course, Marisette is always in need of funds to continue our research activities. We are looking for funds for a lot of the awareness campaigns and the stranding workshops. So funding is always in need, but we also welcome any other form of support, whether it's through your skill, your time, your manpower, or even just support us in our events. We host events every few months, and whenever you see those events happening, you know, we do want you to come and just get to know more about what we do.
For more information, you can visit Marisette.org. That's Marecet.org. And to support Davina Goh's campaign, you can visit simplygiving.com/DavinaSwims. Thank you both very much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Dr. Louisa Panampalam and Fairuz Ismail of the Marisette Research Organization. We've been talking about marine mammal strandings today on Earth Matters. You've been listening to The Bigger Picture on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.